Healthcare is the only industry that we have where we as consumers don't know the price.
Alaska lawmakers consider requiring medical cost information to be made public. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska police could soon see changes to the legality of certain sting operations against sex workers.
Close a loophole and eliminate a gray area about sexual contact during police investigations.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
When Alaskans buy candy bars, they know how much they're going to pay before they make the purchase. The same isn't true for healthcare. Lawmakers are looking to change that. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on a new bill.
Alaskans pay more for healthcare than anyone in the country. Anchorage Democratic Representative Ivy Sponholz wants them to know more about what they're going to pay before they decide on a procedure. That's why she's introduced House Bill 123, which would require the state and healthcare providers to post a list price of common procedures.
Healthcare is the only industry that we have where we as consumers don't know the price before we make a purchase or we utilize a service. This removes one of the fundamental tenets of capitalism, that is the power of the consumer to make choices about what they do or they don't purchase.
Representatives for Alaska hospitals and insurers say they support price transparency, but they don't necessarily agree on what should be included in legislation. For example, the prices that would be available under the bill, known as chargemaster prices, generally are much higher than what any patient or insurer would pay. That's because insurers negotiate discounts with healthcare providers, and uninsured patients usually aren't charged the list price. That's why other states have mandated something called all-payer claims databases. These databases include the amounts that are actually paid by insurers. Sponholz says she considered such a database in Alaska.
But we passed on that because that came with a $500,000 a year price tag, which seemed in this particular fiscal climate to be untenable.
The price lists mandated by the bill aren't expected to cost the state anything. That's because providers would compile the prices based on lists they already have. Becky Holtberg is president of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. She said during a House Health and Social Services Committee meeting Thursday that providers want to work with lawmakers to increase transparency.
The structure of the healthcare payment and delivery system is complicated, and it makes transparency pricing difficult to implement, even when all parties agree on its desirability.
Prices are based on the severity of patients' problems, the amount of required treatment, and negotiations between insurers and providers. Some of these factors aren't known before treatment starts. And Holtberg notes people who have insurance plans that don't require a lot of out-of-pocket expenses may not care about the prices.
Economic theory and also reality support the idea that most consumers are only price sensitive and engaged in price shopping up to the point of their out-of-pocket exposure.
A separate concern was raised by John Zasada of the Alaska Primary Care Association. He directs policy for the group, which is made up of the state's community health centers. He says that publicly posting list prices may mislead patients, since the centers charge patients based on a sliding scale that depends on their income. Centers don't want to scare patients away with prices they won't pay.
We'd hate to potential patients off from seeking, you know, primary and preventive care.
Members of Premera, the state's largest insurer, can get out-of-pocket cost estimates from the insurer based on their provider and the procedure. Premera spokeswoman Melanie Kuhn says the company is monitoring the bill's progress.
If people can have a better understanding of healthcare costs in general and the healthcare services they're paying for, that's our ultimate goal for our customers.
Public testimony on the bill will be held on Tuesday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Law enforcement officers in Alaska can legally have sexual contact with people they are investigating for crimes. Proposed legislation seeks to change that.
Brought House Bill 1124 to close a loophole and eliminate a gray area about sexual contact during police investigations.
That's Anchorage Democrat Representative Matt Klayman. He says he proposed the bill after seeing research conducted on behalf of a sex worker advocacy group. The statewide telephone survey was completed by Hayes Research, which has run surveys and focus groups in the state for more than a decade. It shows that more than 90% of the people surveyed didn't know that police officers could legally have intercourse with sex workers, and they do not think it should be legal. Maxine Dugan is a sex worker advocate. She says current law only protects people who are in custody, not people who are under investigation.
Because what happens in prostitution sting operations is that you're in a state of being investigated, not technically in custody. So police are allowed to have sexual contact in prostitution sting operations because it's part of investigating prostitution.
Dugan says multiple women have reported sexual contact with law enforcement officers to her organization, Community United for Safety and Protection. A spokesperson for the Alaska State Troopers says they have a policy against sexual contact during investigations. The Anchorage Police Department did not respond to multiple requests for comment. 58% of the people surveyed say they do not think the state should be expending resources arresting consenting adults for prostitution. Dugan says her organization is also pushing for legislation that would remove prostitution charges from a person's criminal record and from court view. She says those public records make it hard for women to move out of the industry and take other jobs.
When people have those, you know, really stigmatizing things on their records, it prohibits them from being, you know, hired in certain jobs. So there's a high level of discrimination against our population when people are looking to transition into other occupations.
No legislation to remove the charges has been proposed yet. The state is fining oil and gas company Hillcorp $200,000 for a 2015 incident that nearly killed three workers on the North Slope. The final order amount, which was released today, is a significant reduction from the $720,000 penalty the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission proposed last year. In September 2015, three Hillcorp contractors were knocked unconscious when nitrogen filled their trailer while they were working at the Milne Point unit. After investigating the incident, AOGCC took the highly unusual step of shutting down all four of Hillcorp's rigs operating on existing wells in the state for nearly a month. The agency says that had a big financial impact on the company, and that's partly why it's reducing the fine. In the order, AOGCC also notes Hillcorp has a significant history of non-compliance, but in the past year has improved compliance. In a statement, Hillcorp says it doesn't plan to appeal the order. The company says it's taken steps to avoid a similar incident in the future. Hillcorp is responsible for a natural gas leak from a pipeline in Cook Inlet that is releasing between 210,000 and 310,000 cubic feet of gas per day. The company says it won't be able to begin repairs on the line until mid to late March. Two people were rescued today after their small plane made an emergency landing near an Alaska island. The Coast Guard credits local authorities and others from the nearby community of Metlakatla for quickly responding to the scene in Smuggler Cove off Annette Island. The Coast Guard also helped in the response. Petty Officer Lauren Stinson says the people rescued were taken to the Metlakatla Clinic for treatment of minor injuries. Officials say because of icing on the BE-18 Beechcraft plane, the pilot missed the approach to the Ketchikan Airport. Officials say the pilot diverted the aircraft for an emergency landing on the island, but instead had to make the emergency landing in the water. Officials say restricted visibility and 6-foot seas were reported at the scene. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Fairbanks gets ready to welcome thousands of airmen that will support new fighter jets.
It's the foundation of the F-35 bed down coming in, but these facilities are so needed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Ryan Reddington will be the first musher to hit the trail Monday morning in this year's Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. The grandson of Iditarod Race founder Joe Reddington Sr., the younger Reddington pulled bib number 2 from a muckluck at the Iditarod Mushers Banquet last night. In Saturday's ceremonial start in Anchorage, Reddington will follow the honorary musher, Leo Rasmussen, down 4th Avenue. Rasmussen has been the checker under the Burled Arch in Nome since the race began. Rasmussen served as president of the Iditarod Board of Directors and organizes the Trail Mail Program. 72 mushers are slated to run their teams from Fairbanks to Nome. Race officials rerouted the trail over safety concerns due to low snow conditions in the Alaska Range earlier this year. Weather conditions in the interior are expected to have daytime highs just below zero and approach 30 below overnight in the first few days of the race. An exceptionally white winter for much of the area and recent accumulation have piled snow along much of the early trail. Four-time defending champion Dallas Seavey drew bib number 18. A federal study says more shrubs growing on Arctic tundra likely will have little effect on the abundance of most bird species until the vegetation grows tall. The study by U.S. Geological Survey researchers says the height of shrubs growing on tundra is a critical factor in whether birds will stick around. Research wildlife biologist Sarah Thompson says the study looked at 17 bird species on Alaska's Seward Peninsula over 3 breeding seasons. She says multiple studies have shown tundra getting more shrub growth as the climate continues to warm and the growing season expands. Thompson says the research didn't explain why tall shrubs made tundra less appealing to birds. She says the study was aimed at assessing how birds may exist as habitat changes with future climate warming. The F-35 stealth fighter has faced a lot of challenges over the years. The aircraft is already the most expensive military project in the Defense Department's history, with costs expected to ultimately total $1.5 trillion. The program got yet another prominent critic when then-President-elect Trump went after it on Twitter. But as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, communities like Fairbanks that have spent years trying to lure the military into basing new fighter squadrons nearby aren't feeling nervous. In fact, they're already seeing some economic benefits.
In Alaska, the F-35 has a lot of boosters.
So what I tell my 7-year-old is that I am building buildings to house the jets that are going to protect our freedom.
Monica Velasco is in charge of the F-35 bed-down program for the Army Corps of Engineers in Alaska. And we're talking at the Corps' headquarters on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Velasco brings me to her sparsely furnished office and raises the standing desk to show off a digital copy of a recently awarded contract.
Okay, a little bit of patience because sometimes these contracts are very, very large. As you can see there, it's almost 2,500 pages.
The massive document is just for a single building that'll house a flight simulator at Eielson Air Force Base just outside Fairbanks. It doesn't even include the actual simulator. The contract was awarded to a construction company in Anchorage and is one of just 19 projects overseen by the Corps of Engineers as it gets ready to bring 2 squadrons of F-35s to Alaska. Velasco says people are really excited about even plain buildings like this one.
It's the foundation of the F-35 bed down coming in, but these facilities are so needed in order to house the pilots, house the equipment, house everything that's going to support this bed down.
The F-35s will bring two economic bumps to Alaska. The first is in new military construction, which has gone up more than tenfold from last year, almost $300 million. As the Corps bids out the remainder of the contracts, Velasco expects more than half a billion in construction dollars to come into the state.
So we have a dining facility, we have maintenance facilities, a couple renovation projects, and then hangars and weather shelters.
The second economic boost is in operating and sustaining the 54 new planes that'll be stored at Eielson Air Force Base and used in training missions. Fairbanks depends heavily on the military, which accounts for 38% of the town's payroll. The two squadrons are expected to bring with them another 3,500 military personnel, contractors, and family members. That's about 10% of the town's population. And at a time when low oil prices are hitting Alaska's economy hard, that's the kind of fiscal reliability that makes it politically viable to push for the F-35 program while simultaneously bemoaning its excesses.
I'm a defender of the final product, but in terms of the production and the cost overruns and the delays, I'm not a defender of that at all.
Alaska Republican Dan Sullivan sits on the Senate's Armed Services Committee. He is adamant that the new plane's warfighting capabilities put it in a league of its own, a conclusion that some dispute. But he says there's no harm in what President Trump has done, posing problems with the project and the manufacturer, Lockheed Martin, in a very public way, as Trump did during a January press event.
It's way, way behind schedule and many, many billions of dollars over budget. I don't like that.
In these critiques, Trump is hardly the first. In fact, pointing out the massive cost overruns of the ambitious project unites even regular critics of the president, like Arizona Republican Senator John McCain.
The F-35's program's record of performance has been both a scandal and a tragedy with respect to cost, schedule, and performance.
As the planes continue rolling out the next few years, an expensive new phase of buying and maintaining the fleet will begin, with the Defense Department annually spending an average of $13 billion until 2040. But those same funds are a light on the horizon to contractors, businesses, and local governments in places like Fairbanks. Similar to Velasco with the Corps of Engineers, Sullivan's not worried that the F-35 program will get derailed by public criticism from Trump. The program got underway in the 90s and is on its fourth presidential administration. Between Alaska's value as a strategic basing location and strong community buy-in, Sullivan says he's confident Eielson will get both its squadrons by 2020. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
If you're looking for ways to enhance your business knowledge about government contracting, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center statewide annual conference in Anchorage on March 8th. The PTAC conference presents a day of general sessions, learning labs, networking, and the popular Perfect Pitch competition. There will also be an opportunity to interact with representatives from government agencies. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, ambassadors in training. The Arctic Council returns to Alaska with meetings in Juneau next week and Fairbanks in May. Representatives from 8 Arctic countries and 6 indigenous groups will work together to help shape Arctic policy. To understand the work of the Council firsthand, a group of university students met in Fairbanks last spring to form their own model council with real-world impacts. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
The Model Arctic Council is a simulation where future leaders in Arctic and international affairs hone their negotiation, leadership, and research skills. It's much like the Model United Nations in high school, but this time it's college students role-playing representatives from circumpolar countries as they tackle problems together in a rapidly changing Arctic. 63 college students from 13 countries, ranging from Iceland to Venezuela, compress as much as 2 years' worth of work into a little over a week. Veronica Guido, an indigenous student with a degree in political science from York University in Toronto, says they either represented the Arctic Council's member states or the non-voting representatives of the various circumpolar indigenous groups.
You have the indigenous groups from Russia, you have the Sami Council, Inuit Circumpolar Council, Aleut, and you have the Arctic Athabaskan.
Mary Erlander, director of the Arctic and Northern Studies Program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, was a faculty advisor to the group. She says they tried to match indigenous students to a role that was close to their ethnic background.
Because we wanted to have authenticity in that way. On the other hand, some of the students seem to have the greatest experience with trying to play a role that wasn't them at all, and that was really a learning experience for them to take on that identity and try to perform it.
Students prepared research papers on topics such as sustainable cruise tourism in the Arctic, managing maritime traffic for marine resource development, and human health and well-being in the Arctic. Eva Wu is an undergrad from McGill University in Canada studying the interplay between health and the environment, and she says she was impressed by the level of preparation and critical analysis demonstrated by her fellow students.
It was really amazing, like the amount of people and the variety of people who were in the room. They provided numerous different aspects and perspectives of the situation, and that really was able to provide the entire program with a holistic focus. Like, people would have expertise in various different areas.
The Model Arctic Council came up with a list of priorities that may be considered by their real-world counterparts next week. They include advocating for ratification of an international convention controlling vessel ballast water, the hiring of indigenous people for tourism activities, alternative fuel use in the Arctic, sharing updated hydrographic maps for safe navigation, protecting water sources for communities affected by climate change, and reducing suicide among indigenous groups. Some students play the role of each country's representative to the Arctic Council, while others represent the various indigenous groups called permanent participants as they all discuss and debate the projects. Here's Guido reflecting on her role as the Gwich'in representative.
So I took my role very personally, and it was really great to see other people respect that and stay in their role while still having kind of getting over the shock factor of having the actual permanent participants speak just as loudly or louder than the actual nation states. I enjoyed that part, that's for sure.
Once consensus was reached, students role-playing each country's representatives to the council vote on the proposals, but the permanent participants do not get to vote. Rhiannon Klein, who's studying public policy at the University of Saskatchewan, says it works much like the real-world Arctic Council.
The fact that the Arctic Council is not legally binding necessarily, they don't have direct influence on making the policies at the government level in each of the countries, but they truly have an impact on shaping the policies that happen. And I believe that the Arctic Council has quite a bit of sway within decision-makers in each of the Arctic state countries.
Last spring's meeting of the Model Arctic Council coincided with the real Arctic Council meeting, and Guido says council members grabbed copies of their final document called the Fairbanks Declaration, as well as her fellow students' research papers.
People approached them from the actual Arctic Council asking to read them further, so I know a lot of students didn't expect anyone to read our position papers either.
Klein says students were also approached by the Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs.
They've asked to see all the students' position papers as well to pass them around the ministry. So it's just incredible to see that people are actually interested too.
Students' proposals are now expected to show up on the agenda in future meetings of the Real Arctic Council, including in Alaska this spring. At the Model Arctic Council, tomorrow's Arctic leaders are already having an impact with helping shape today's Arctic policy. For AK, I'm Matt Miller reporting.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Ivan Simonek in Wrangell. Simonek immigrated from Czechoslovakia in the 60s.
Well, the thing is that I'm probably somehow American, born in the wrong place, because I always look up to the United States as a land of unlimited opportunities where dreams can come true. So I wanted to become American, but in communist system there was no way to peacefully emigrate. So basically person would have to escape from there. They made sure that you don't have any chances. So in that chaos, we managed to sneak out on pretense that we are traveling to prepaid vacation to Yugoslavia. We didn't know what was ahead of us and what America was really all about, but yeah, we figured it will be much better than what we experienced. So I took my chances and I corresponded with a young couple living here in Durango and another guy living in Anchorage. He was a lawyer and he became our sponsor. We entered the United States on November 1968 through Seattle. We had to overnight in Juneau. So we were hungry and we didn't know the groceries in this country. We couldn't tell the packages, what was what. The only thing which we recognized was Coca-Cola and Kellogg's Frosted Flakes. So that's what we had for dinner. Coke and Frosted Flakes. And the next day we got on the plane and landed in Wrangell on the 22nd November, and it was an absolutely bad day. It was blowing, raining, snowing, overcast, and we said, oh boy, what did we got into,
Ivan Simonek lives in Wrangell. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Matt Miller and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Ann Hillman, Annie Fite, Ben Matheson, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. The Seward Peninsula Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Nome March 6th and 7th at the Mini Convention Center from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.